The company claims that it can reach operations by 2031, which would be light speed, as per what you said previously. This is commercially unproven technology. There is capital behind this company now to make this all happen. But that said, it's kind of a moonshot, which follows sort of a well-worn path. If you were sort of to step back and look at the Trump interests, broadly speaking, they play in very speculative, highly risky corners of financial markets. And this is definitely one of those areas.
And the idea that the executive order says you cannot regulate AI data centers. I mean, a lot of the activism around the country now is around communities deeply concerned about these energy centers. President Trump is saying this would now be against the law.
Right. Those community organizations in different places around the country, which I visited, they are anathema to this idea of building out data centers as quickly as possible. You add in the element of the administration being very antagonistic toward renewable energy, things like solar and wind power. Solar in particular is very proven and quite cheap in some circumstances, and instead being all in on fossil fuels, which are obviously more polluting in many circumstances, as well as this more unproven technology of nuclear, which the U.S. has a very checkered history with.
We have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two after the show. David Huberti of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
If you think the art of conversation is dead, you probably haven't listened to Jonesy. Or maybe you have. In any case, Jonesy brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I should know, I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. A tagline I've long since beaten into the ground. So tune into KBOO on air or online every second and fourth Thursday of the month at 10:30 a.m.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Rumble on the River, presenting their 28th community forum, What's the Deal with Data Centers? On Wednesday, January 7th at 825 Northwest 18th Avenue. Doors and info tables at 5:30 p.m. and community panel at 6:30 p.m. More info available at 350pdx.org/event.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers plan to introduce a law allowing people to sue federal agents who violate their rights. TriMet faces big service cuts. And in international news, the Prime Minister of Denmark says American seizure of Greenland would mean the end of NATO. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 6, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon's short state legislative session starts on February 2nd, and two lawmakers say they'll introduce a bill that would allow Oregonians to sue federal officers who violate their rights. The bill comes from Representatives Leslie Munoz from Woodburn and Ricky Ruiz from Gresham. They call it the Protect Your Door Act. The sponsors say they've heard from their constituents that discrimination from immigration agents is a big concern. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution protects people against unreasonable search and seizure. Immigration raids conducted in Oregon over the past few months likely run afoul of that protection. Their proposed bill would allow Oregonians to sue individual agents who violate their Fourth Amendment rights. Federal law allows people to sue their government, but not individual agents. It also provides federal employees legal immunity for any work they do for the government. But there's an exception in that law if the government employees violate the Constitution. Legal experts say that provision is untested, but Oregon has a good case to say that this is allowed. The Oregon bill would only apply to federal agents, not state or local law enforcement. It would also require federal immigration agents to give local authorities 48 hours notice before doing any work in their jurisdiction. Former ICE detainees and their lawyers describe conditions at an immigration processing facility in Burlington, Massachusetts, as overcrowded and inhumane. A growing number of activists opposed to ICE activity in the region are holding multiple weekly vigils outside the building to bear witness and show collective support for immigrant rights. Catherine Carley has more.
As more immigrants are detained in Massachusetts, a growing number of protesters are holding weekly vigils to bear witness and show their support for immigrant rights. Activists attend multiple weekly gatherings outside the ICE processing facility in Burlington, which has been described by former detainees as overcrowded and inhumane. Todd Palmer with the Greater Assabet Indivisible Network says people are sleeping on concrete floors in windowless rooms where the lights are always on.
This is a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishments. And that really was part of what drew me out there to think that such a thing was happening in Massachusetts.
Nearly 9,000 people across New England were detained by ICE last year. Many were processed through the Burlington facility. Palmer says the vigils are peaceful, often joyful, and show immigrant families they are not alone. The number of people being held in immigration detention in the U.S. hit an all-time high of more than 68,000 people in mid-December. Despite federal officials claiming to target what they call the worst of the worst, data show nearly half of those detained since October had no criminal conviction nor pending criminal charges. Palmer says ICE agents generally ignore protesters and have grown accustomed to the growing crowd.
ICE knows that they're going to be there at that time. The Burlington police are very well aware, and I think that is a large reason why so far at that facility everything has remained peaceful.
Palmer says the vigils have been ongoing since April and attendance by various groups can often top more than 500 people. Other vigils regularly take place at the Plymouth County Correction Facility and Hanscom Field Airport in Bedford, where Governor Maura Healey has demanded ICE stop using private aircraft to carry out deportations before people are given access to legal counsel. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
A second round of TriMet cuts is on the horizon, and members of the public have until the end of the month to weigh in on the proposed cuts. The regional transit agency faces a $300 million budget gap. They cite rising inflation and low ridership as reasons for the gap, which dates back to before the pandemic. TriMet said in a statement, quote, "With rising costs and less money coming in, we must reduce spending now to avoid more severe cuts down the road, which would affect many more riders," end quote. The biggest proposed cut would eliminate nearly half of the Max Green Line. Currently, that runs from Clackamas Town Center to Portland State University. In August, TriMet could cut off service at the Gateway Transit Center in Northeast Portland, eliminating the connection to downtown. It would be the first time the Transit Authority has cut a Max line. Tentative plans also include changes to 35 bus lines. TriMet may cut all bus service in South Gresham along Stafford and Salomo Roads in West Lynn and Tualatin Sherwood Road in Tualatin. Fare increases are also likely to come in 2028. TriMet is holding 11 open houses across the region this month. Users can find in-person and virtual open houses and feedback forms on TriMet's website at trimet.org. Over Christmas, the U.S. Postal Service changed the meaning of the term postmark. Before, mail would be marked as postmarked when it was picked up at a local post office. Now, mail will only be postmarked when it reaches a processing facility, something people mailing important letters and parcels don't have control over. Think ballots and tax returns. The Postal Service hasn't been specific about which post offices and areas are likely to be most affected in Oregon or across the U.S. Suzanne Potter spoke to a rural democracy advocate in California who says it will cause large numbers of votes in less populated areas to be thrown out. Portland's ban on gas-powered leaf blowers is in effect starting January 1st. It was passed by City Council 2 years ago, but had been a part of political conversations since 2018. It's meant to cut down on negative health impacts from noise and air pollution. Lawmakers also hope it will help protect landscapers who face the biggest exposure to those types of pollution. Electric leaf blowers are okay to use. Crews are technically allowed to use gas-powered leaf blowers in the rainy winter months for the next 2 years, but by 2028, they'll be phased out year-round. Nicolas Maduro pleads not guilty to federal drug trafficking charges. U.S. officials debate the value and future of the Venezuela operation. And Minnesota Governor Tim Walz drops his reelection bid. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Venezuela comes before this council today with a deep conviction that international peace can only be sustained if international law is respected without exception, without double standards, and without selective interpretations.
Speaking to the UN Security Council, Venezuelan Ambassador Samuel Moncada accused the U.S. of kidnapping President Nicolas Maduro and First Lady Celia Flores. Many in the international community warned the military operation that captured Maduro and his wife sets a bad precedent for situations like China's conflict with Taiwan or Russia's war with Ukraine. The two were arraigned on federal drug trafficking charges in New York and pleaded not guilty. Maduro argued he has immunity from U.S. law enforcement as Venezuela's sovereign leader, but to the Security Council, U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz called the operation U.S. self-defense and a necessary enforcement of narcotics law.
The United States arrested a narco-trafficker who is now going to stand trial in the United States in accordance with the rule of law for the crimes he's committed against our people for 15 years.
The White House is sending mixed messages about what lies ahead for the South American nation. President Donald Trump says the U.S. will run Venezuela, but Waltz and Secretary of State Marco Rubio say the U.S. will not put forces on land there and will in fact leave day-to-day government decisions to the regime Maduro left behind. Some ordinary Venezuelans are celebrating the end of his dictatorship, but others in the country are protesting for his return, tapping into a deep historical resentment of U.S. intervention. Members of Congress are unsure about the operation's legality and wisdom. Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott says this won't just create opportunities for Venezuela, but seizing control of the oil industry will benefit Americans.
We're going to have a new trading partner. People we know, our friends and our family, are going to be able to live their dream in Venezuela. We're going to have lower oil and gas prices. We're going to have a great trading partner. This is going to be outstanding.
Critics of U.S. military intervention and nation building in both parties are arguing it has a bad record, drawing comparisons with Iraq and Panama. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says as much as Maduro was illegitimate, sending the army to remove him is unprecedented.
Maduro is a bad guy, a dictator, someone who was not the legitimate head of government or head of state in Venezuela. We also know the future of the Venezuelan people should be determined by the Venezuelan people, not by Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, or Stephen Miller.
Meanwhile, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is dropping his reelection bid amid a scandal over widespread benefits fraud. Anastasia Belladonna Carrera with Common Cause Minnesota says when political scorekeeping is prioritized, true reforms are at risk of falling apart.
So I always ask people to ask themselves when they see things like this coming up, who benefits from how these decisions are made or from the actual solution that they are proposing?
A Trump administration investigation of Minnesota state programs and a freezing of federal child care payments nationwide followed a right-wing influencer's video claiming widespread fraud in Somali-led daycare centers. Skeptics question the video content's credibility and argue the ripple effect is disproportionate. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly rainy as well, with some mixed precipitation in the morning and a daytime high of 44 degrees. Today in history, in 2021, Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol to disrupt the certification of the 2020 election. The insurrection resulted in 4 deaths and the evacuation of the U.S. Congress. The quote of the day is from Lebanese-American writer Kahil Gibran, born this day in 1883. He wrote, quote, "Yesterday we obeyed kings and bent our necks before emperors, but today we kneel only to truth, follow only beauty, and obey only love." State legislators go back into session later this month. In Arizona, Democratic lawmakers held a town hall on missing and murdered indigenous peoples. Though Arizona did institute a turquoise alert for missing indigenous people, only 1 in 5 were actually for an indigenous person. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Ahead of the next legislative session this month, Arizona Democratic state lawmakers held a town hall at the end of December on MMIP, or Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
Indigenous Peoples Caucus Chair Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez, who is Pascua Yaqui, made no promises.
We will not have solutions for you today.
But she and others spent 3 hours listening.
Listening without action has become a pattern.
Reva Stewart, who is Diné, believes families relive their trauma by testifying with no results.
Legislation without enforcement is not protection. Task force without authority or accountability are not solutions. Meetings without funding are not justice.
Roxanne Barley, who is Kokopah, complained that criteria changed for the state's turquoise alert, originally designed to notify the public of indigenous disappearances. Of the 5 alerts, only 1 has been for a Native American, a teen in Yuma.
That was the lie that we were promised. That was the hoax that we were told.
But Senator Teresa Hatachly, who is Diné, explained how lawmakers compromised.
And that is the ugly truth of politics.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Alaska state health officials continue to recommend the hepatitis B vaccine for all newborns, despite a recent controversial change in federal guidance. The virus has historically seriously impacted Alaska Native communities, as Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
Hepatitis B is a virus spread through bodily fluids and from mother to baby during childbirth. Historically, Alaska has had high rates of hepatitis B, especially among Alaska Native people. In the 1970s, widespread infection led to high rates of liver cancer in Alaska Native children. State Epidemiology Chief Dr. Joe McLaughlin says screening and vaccinations have helped reduce rates of hepatitis B in the state. And McLaughlin says the vaccine is still important in Alaska, which has struggled with high rates of chronic hepatitis B.
This universal birth dosing helps to ensure every baby receives protection, regardless of their location, their access to care, or any follow-up challenges that they might have. This approach has definitely helped reduce disparities in hepatitis B outcomes across Alaska for decades.
Public health experts credit the vaccine with dramatically lowering the risk of developing chronic hepatitis B, serious liver diseases, and liver cancer. For over 3 decades, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that all babies across the country get the vaccine at birth. Then last month, the CDC narrowed its guidance, recommending the vaccine only for infants born to women who test positive for the virus or whose status is unknown. The guidance says women who test negative should consult a healthcare provider before vaccinating their newborn. But McLaughlin emphasizes that the CDC also acknowledged that each state has to consider its own hepatitis B rates and risk factors.
Alaska, where the rates are nearly 3 times the national average, clearly falls into a higher risk category as a state in general. And our data support continuing universal birth dose vaccination to protect infants in Alaska.
Health insurers have said they will continue to cover the hepatitis B vaccine. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The president has renewed his calls for the U.S. to take over Greenland, which is a semi-autonomous territory of Denmark. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said that would equate to the end of the NATO military alliance. Frederiksen and the Prime Minister of Greenland, Jens Frederik Nielsen, savaged Trump's comments and warned of potentially catastrophic consequences. Other European leaders expressed solidarity. Frederiksen said, quote, "If the United States chose to attack another NATO country militarily, then everything stops. That is, including our NATO, and thus the security that has been provided since the end of the Second World War," end quote. She added, quote, "We will not accept a situation where we and Greenland are threatened in this way." Both Greenlanders and Danes were further bothered this weekend by a social media post by a former Trump administration official turned podcaster, Katie Miller. That post shows an illustrated map of Greenland in the colors of the stars and stripes, accompanied with a caption saying, quote, "Soon." The United States Department of Defense operates a space base in northwestern Greenland. It was built following a 1951 defense agreement between Denmark and the United States, and it supports missile warning, missile defense, and space surveillance operations for the U.S. and NATO. Denmark regularly buys American F-35 fighter jets, and just last year approved a bill to allow U.S. military bases on Danish soil. Now we go to global citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says President Trump's invasion and threatened occupation of Venezuela has all the markings of imperialism. U.S. oil companies stand to benefit the most. Trump's triumph may be short-lived as Venezuelans realize that regime change without democracy is no change at all, and Republicans rebel against the sellout of America First. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The United States has overthrown the Maduro regime in Venezuela, captured its leader, Nicolas Maduro, and occupied the country. Continuing a long history of U.S. interventions in Latin America, Trump has vowed to, quote, run the country until such time that we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. The U.S. policy of regime change had been telegraphed for months as Trump ramped up attacks on supposed Venezuelan drug boats, imposed an oil blockade, and ordered a CIA drone strike on a Venezuelan dock alleged to be used for loading drugs. Now those clear violations of international and U.S. law and false allegations about Venezuela's role in the fentanyl trade, its theft of U.S. oil, and its ties to narco-terrorist gangs are ending with an occupation and U.S. control of Venezuela's oil-based economy. The U.S. action is consistent with America First, said Trump, citing the need for oil and energy. The U.S. will be in charge of Venezuela's oil industry. So, in a word, it's imperialism, and a clear sign that for Trump, dominance in Latin America is his top foreign policy objective. We now await word about whom Trump will select to be America's puppet in Caracas. He has already ruled out the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Corina Machado, and who among his inner circle will become head of the occupation. The U.S. intervention comes despite a call by Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum for U.N. action to prevent the crisis, warning that the U.N. silence could have dangerous consequences. Now Mexico could be next on Trump's crusade. The cartels are running Mexico, he said. She's not running it. I've asked her numerous times, would you like us to take out the cartels? Something is going to have to be done with Mexico, Trump said. Then there's Colombia. Trump has called Colombia's president Gustavo Petro an illegal drug leader and warned last month that he could be next. Just the other day, Trump said Petro should, quote, watch his ass. Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, and Brazil were among the Latin American countries that have condemned the U.S. invasion of Venezuela. President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil said the U.S. attacks, quote, crossed an unacceptable line, set a dangerous precedent, and evoked the worst moments of interference in Latin America. Russia also criticized the U.S., but Moscow must be pleased that the U.S. has emulated Russia in attacking a sovereign nation. Trump has given the Russians and the Chinese a major propaganda victory. Reactions in the U.S. to the attack on Venezuela run along predictable lines. Democrats are wringing their hands. Republicans are sitting on theirs. Democrats in Congress are once again citing Trump's failure to consult with Congress, much less gain an authorization for the use of force, such as George W. Bush obtained when he went after Saddam Hussein. Some Democrats and foreign policy wonks are citing the dangerous precedent of the U.S. abducting a foreign leader, though it seems to me that invading and occupying another country, while not without precedent in U.S. history, is more dangerous still. The closest Republicans have come to criticism of Trump's action has been expressions of the need for an examination of the facts behind the decision to attack, as though the facts aren't abundantly clear already. Among the many points left unsaid was Trump's violation of his promise not to involve the U.S. in new interventions abroad. And the invasion is another instance of Trump's lawlessness, as Harold Cole, a former legal advisor to the State Department, says, quote, Trump has baldly violated the UN Charter with no valid claim of self-defense and engaged in an illegal extraterritorial arrest that will be vigorously contested in a U.S. court. One thing is certain, Trump's running of Venezuela will be a disaster for its people and for Trump's presidency. The same people who have run the U.S. economy into the ground will be presiding over Venezuela's economy. Only the naive believe Trump when he says Venezuelans will benefit from, quote, a tremendous amount of wealth out of the ground. He and the oil companies, which Trump expects will invest billions of dollars in Venezuela, will be the only beneficiaries. The country will be a U.S. colony, and its new leader, Venezuela's vice president, has fled to Moscow, will be beholden to Trump, who has said nothing about restoring democracy in Venezuela. All those Venezuelans who are now waving American flags in the country's streets are in for a profound disappointment. The day of reckoning for Trump will start when those same Venezuelans demonstrate, shouting, Yankee, go home. Polls before the invasion showed around 75% of Americans opposed one. Watch the Republicans squirm as they try to explain to constituents why the Trump administration is spending enormous sums on drug trafficking and oil extraction abroad, while the U.S. economy tanks and drug addiction remains no closer to being resolved. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
The second Friday after New Year's is often called Quitter's Day, because that's usually when people backslide on their New Year's resolutions. The nicotine prevention organization Truth Initiative has renamed it You Got This Day and is offering resources for young people to quit smoking. Eric Tegedoff has the details in North Carolina.
For people resolving to quit smoking in the new year, keeping up this commitment can be hard. A group called Truth Initiative is offering resources for folks who want to stay away from nicotine in 2026. About two-thirds of people ages 18 to 24 plan to quit smoking or vaping in 2026, according to Truth Initiative data. But the second Friday after the start of the new year is sometimes labeled Quitter's Day, because it's often when people backslide on their resolutions. To counteract this, the nicotine prevention organization launched You Got This Day in its place. It's on January 9th this year. Megan Jacobs with Truth Initiative says the day offers a chance to inform young people about the organization's research-driven X program.
We introduced this back in 2024 as a campaign to introduce young people to our free quitting program called X Program to really drive awareness of that resource through a series of different mechanisms that celebrate the everyday victories that lead to breaking free from nicotine addiction for good.
X Program is a partnership with Mayo Clinic, which provides a free and anonymous digital quitting program. The adult tobacco use rate in North Carolina is about 21%, according to the American Lung Association, contributing to more than 14,000 deaths in the state each year. Jacobs says people need resources to quit nicotine successfully.
Only 3 to 5% of people who try to quit cold turkey will be able to be successful long term. And we know that using X Program can increase an individual's odds of quitting by up to 40%.
Vaping is most prevalent among young people, but Jacobs notes that it's no less dangerous to their health than smoking cigarettes. She says it's easy for people to become part of Truth Initiative's latest quitting campaign.
Those looking to enroll in X Program in North Carolina can do so for free by texting VAPEFREENC to 88709.
For North Carolina News Service, I'm Eric Tegeda.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 6, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. I have been a vocal and harsh critic of the so-called Fix Our Forests Act, or FOFA, that is making its way through Congress. I'm not going to mince words. I think it's a cynical, bad faith bill that, at best, doesn't address the wildfire issues it purports to solve, and I think could actually make those issues much worse. Combined with the attempt by the administration to repeal the roadless rule, which protects vast swaths of public lands from road construction and extraction, and the Trump administration's executive orders dramatically increasing timber production targets on public lands, I really fear we are in danger of the kind of rampant ecosystem degradation or even destruction that we haven't seen since the darkest days of the timber wars. And I'm not alone. The vast majority of environmental and conservation organizations that I'm aware of are fiercely opposed to FOFA. So I was really surprised to see some organizations that I definitely respect lobbying hard in support of the bills. One of those organizations is Citizens Climate Lobby, a nonpartisan grassroots climate advocacy group that I really respect and have worked with before. I think that disagreeing respectfully and really listening to conflicting perspectives is a key part of civic engagement in a pluralistic society. So I invited them to come on the show and talk through the bill and some of our differences. Before we get started, I would love to hear from you. Yes, you! Send me an email sometime at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. You can follow Coast Range Radio on Instagram, send me a message there, and of course you can subscribe, free and ad-free, to our podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the places. Okay, Dana Nucitelli, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Yeah, hey Michael, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being